So we are in 2 Samuel chapter 11, if you would turn there. Neil, just a note on the, if you don't mind, keep an eye on that meter to make sure the batteries don't run out. But as I mentioned, we have been studying the Kings, and so we've been looking at David and his transition to power. And what we noted last week, a couple of things here, was first, we noted how David began to really reflect on his desire to build a house for God, that those first kind of ideas started coming to his mind. You'll get more about that as we move on, and we'll talk more about that. But he also, on that, offered the prayer of gratitude. We looked at that real quickly. And him just, out of the kind of heart he had a great desire to say thank you to God, and how there's so much we can learn from that. He also, we noted how he won a series of victories. During this period of David's reign, the nation of Israel is becoming powerful through God's help. It's defeating its enemies. It's really a golden age for Israel during this period of time. Now that's important to note as we transition into tonight's lesson, and we notice there's a little bit of a change that occurs, and we notice the pivot point, and we need to on that. We'll get to that in just a minute. And then we also noted how David showed great kindness to Jonathan's last remaining son, Mephibosheth, and bringing him into his own household, letting him eat at his table. David really shows his character there. Okay, so in tonight's studies, we move forward. Tonight, I'm going to deal with two things, hopefully both of these. David and his sin with Bathsheba. As I mentioned before, this is really serves as a big turning point in David's reign and his own life. We'll have a lot to say about that. And then we're also going to talk about the results of that. And one of the things that the writer of 2 Samuel goes into detail to note about is David's reaction to the death of his son, to his illness, and then his death, because ultimately his death. All right, so as I mentioned, let's go ahead and turn in your Bibles to 2 Samuel chapter 11. That's where we'll get started. If you look there at verse 1, the text tells us it was the spring of the year, and he put a special note here for us, and this really kind of sets up what proceeds after. He says the time, it's the spring of the year when the time when kings go out to battle. So it's just something that the kings would do. They would go out to defend their land, their property from other nations, their people. And so that's the normal time of year. However, what's the very first phrase following that? Well, David sent Joab. David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel. And they ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah. But David remained at Jerusalem. So you notice what David did. He sent Joab. What's the implication of that? Well, do we ever send people to do work we should be doing? None of us in this room have this attitude, but times we hire a preacher to do what? To evangelize, right? What do the rest of us do? You know, do we sometimes, I'm not saying this happens all the time, but sometimes we shift jobs off of other people. Remember the old joke about elders and deacons, right? The elders hire a preacher to do their work. They do the work of the deacons, and the deacons sit around wondering, what do we do? Right? And it's a shifting of task, of responsibility. Well, here's David. What's his job? What was his job? In the springtime, what do the kings do?
Supposed to lead his army, I guess.
He's supposed to lead his armies. That's what the king did. David has always, well, I won't say always done that, but he's always been involved in that. Now, there are times when he sent Joab to do out to a particular battle or someone else. But David's always been involved in the process. This time, he's won a lot of victories, and now, Joab, you go ahead and take care of that. And so he sent Joab rather than to go himself. Well, that's the first step in David's wrong action. Right? Sin is a process, isn't it? Is it sinful that David didn't go to war? No, not sinful, right? Anybody think it's sinful? But did it put him in a bad position, or in a position to where he's ultimately tempted in sins? Had David been where he should have been, would David have had the trouble with Bathsheba? He couldn't have been, right? He would have been somewhere else. Now, there had been some other temptation, maybe, but that particular temptation would not have been in front of him had he done what he'd known. I think there's a reason why the writer Samuel notes that for us. So, not sinful, but not the best idea. You know, I was talking to somebody about this last week. Are all decisions a decision between what's right and wrong? No, most of our decisions are just simply a decision between what's good or what's best, or just simply choosing what's going to put us in a better place. Now, it's not a decision between sin or not sinning, right? But do we ever make decisions that put us in danger of temptation without that particular decision being sin? Absolutely, we do. And so there's a warning here, I think, for us in this regard. And so David starts out, this is not the smartest decision, I don't think. I think he should have made a different one. Well, we see what happens afterwards. And it's always easy to look back in hindsight. Hindsight's always clearer than in the moment, no doubt. Because we know what happens in the following verses. So go down to verse 2. It happened late one afternoon when David arose from his couch and was walking on the roof of the king's house, that he saw from the roof a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful. And David sent and inquired about the woman, and one said, Is not this Bathsheba, the daughter of Elam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? So David sent messengers and took her. And she came to him, and he lay with her. Now she had been purified. Notice this kind of contradictory statement here. She had been purifying herself from her uncleanliness. So she was going through a process of purifying the flesh when this happened. There's some irony there, right? Then she returned to her house, and the woman conceived, and she sent and told David, "I am pregnant." So, what do you note from these verses? Did David just accidentally sin? There was a process to this, wasn't there? Where, like I said before, it was one decision that cascaded, one bad decision cascaded into another bad decision, and ultimately led to him getting himself in a really bad place, and Bathsheba as well. You think about just the process here. Number one, we noted in verse 1 how he wasn't probably where he should have been, and then he finds himself in another place where he probably shouldn't have been. Here he is. Now, was there anything wrong for David to walk about his house? There's nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that at all. Again, but Can there be a bad time to walk around? Obviously there is, right? Now, whether David knew she was going to be there or not, I don't know. The text doesn't tell us that. So I'm not going to try to imply whether he would have known that or not. But here he is. He finds himself. Now, at what point should he have stopped himself?
Right then.
As soon as he hears the water splashing around or hears the voices, right? You think maybe he understood there was something going on that probably he shouldn't see?
I thought so.
Where does the sin begin for him? Where is that line? Y'all gonna have to talk.
When he didn't turn around and go back downstairs.
Do you think maybe it was at the moment he decides, I'm gonna keep on walking? I'm going to keep on looking. Yes, ma'am.
I mean, it was accidental that he stumbled upon seeing her. After that point, his decisions were very conscious, very directed, and pointed to an end result that he wanted.
So it was at the point when he began to make conscious decision where going to a place, either mentally or physically, to something he knew he shouldn't be a part of. So there's a lot of points here where David could stop. Right? He could have, you know, there's a lot of points here where he could have said, you know what, I'm going somewhere I shouldn't go. You know, it was, maybe I shouldn't walk on the roof tonight. Maybe I shouldn't look over there because there's something going on over there I probably shouldn't look. You know, I've seen it, but now I need to really go back. I need to go back and say, this is something I shouldn't look at. Maybe it was at the point where he looks and then he's finding out who she is. Maybe it was at the point where he actually physically had her brought to him. Like, there's so many steps along the way. There's so many... But isn't that true with all of us?
Or at least when you started making arrangements.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many steps along the process here where he could have said no, but he doesn't.
So, I mean, we've all been in, maybe not that specific, but we, you know, a situation where we've seen something we shouldn't have seen, been in a part of a conversation we shouldn't have been a part of a conversation with, went somewhere, we get there and we realize we shouldn't have be there. So, you know, we all make those mistakes. It's how we react to those mistakes after it happens. And in his case, he continued on with the snowball effect versus put the brakes on. Like, whoop, that was bad. That shouldn't happen. Let's go the other way. And like I said, we've all been in those same, you know, various situations that, you know, where we have a choice to make, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Let's go over to 1 Corinthians 10. I know this is one we all know, and maybe some of us even quote. But 1 Corinthians 10:13. The text reads, Paul writing here about temptation. It says, no temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. So he starts off by saying, you can't say that you're in some way, you've been tempted so much worse than everybody else, and it's unfair because your temptation is just too much. Paul says, no, you can't say that. There's no temptation that's overtaken you that is not common, that all people deal with, right? And then he goes on to say, God is faithful. God knows our struggle, right? And he's faithful and he's made a promise to us. He will not let us or let you be tempted beyond your ability. But with the temptation, he will also provide the way of escape that you may be able to endure. So Paul says, you know, temptation, all of us deal with it. Even Jesus, right? Hebrews 4:15. You know, you don't have a high priest, you cannot sympathize with weakness, but in every point tempted as we, right? Jesus understood temptation. Even he suffered a temptation. Paul says, but God is faithful in that he will not let us, and this is a promise to us. He says he will not make it so hard on us, or I'm sorry, he doesn't tempt us, but he will not allow the temptation to get to the point where we as a person are not able to withstand it. Now, you notice what he doesn't say. I think this is important to understand what he doesn't say and what he does. He doesn't say he's going to remove us from all temptation. As a Christian, we all know, and you don't be a Christian very long, to understand that that's not an automatic cure to temptation. You don't become some kind of super person or some kind of vaccinated person to sin where you're just inoculated against any temptation. That's not the way it is, right? You could even say, as a Christian, things might get harder on us at times because Satan knows he wants to get us. But he says that one phrase, that you will be able to, what? Escape. Now, if you go back to David's situation, weren't there a lot of points along the way he could have escaped? There are a lot of opportunities that he had to escape it. Even after, we'll note this later, but even after he commits this act with Bathsheba and sends her away, there's still an opportunity for him at that moment to escape. What's his way of escape at that moment? Where's his escape?
Owning and telling the truth and, you know, facing consequences.
Repenting of it, right, in that moment. Even God provides us a way to escape sin, even on the other side of it, to escape the ultimate consequence of sin. And David doesn't take it right away, does he? And we'll look at that in just a minute, so we'll come back to that. But God provides that way to get out. Now, he provides us a lot of opportunities before it happens. You know, you think about things even in our modern context. You know, there are a lot of temptations, but really all temptations are the same. They just change the form. We're also tempted fleshly, sexually, greed, all those gamut of temptations. They're all basically the same. It's just now we're just tempted in different ways, that we commit those sins in different ways. But you think about some man who's online, or even some woman, right? And they stumble... somehow onto a website or onto a search that they shouldn't be on. Right? In a very similar pattern, they see the image or they see the story and they have a choice to make. Do I click on it and proceed on this path, or do I say, you know what, that's really not somewhere I ought to be. Let me X out of this and get out. Well, hopefully you choose that exit. That's an exit sign for you. There's a big red exit. You can go right out that door and go on to something else. Or you can continue to look. And, you can continue to go further down the road. And it's like walking down this hallway toward an ultimate door that says sin on it. And there's all these steps you take to get there. You could stop anywhere along the way. There's all these exit doors, but you just keep walking. You linger on that website a little longer. Then that spurs another thought in your mind. And then you start, your hands go to the keyboard or to whatever, and you just click on this next search, right? And it's like this building up, this walking down this hallway. And we've got to be wise enough to know all of us are tempted. But with temptation, God provides ways of escape. We all have temptations. We all have things that pull at us that shouldn't. We all make decisions, sometimes we shouldn't. We've got to be wise about looking for the exit signs. You've got a temper, right? You get real angry. There are exit signs along the way before that anger overtakes you and you do something you shouldn't do, right? You go too far. You go over into sin, right? God's provided exit. Did you look for them? Did you take any of them? And so David should be, this whole scenario should be a warning to us, but it should also be an encouragement to us. Look for the exits. Fortunately, he doesn't. Not until the very end. We'll talk about that when we get there. But so David, he goes through this whole thing. You just think about how far he went. This is what sin does. This is what temptation does to us. It wasn't that he just stood there on the rooftop and looked and then went home. It just got in there. And then he had to have a closer look. And then he had to have an experience, right? The flesh pulled at him. And so he just went through each of these doors and continued on. And then finds herself pregnant. Now, what's the sin here? There's actually more than one, isn't there? There's a sin of fornication. There's a sin of adultery, right? There is a sin of lying. There's a lot that's bundled up here. You think about adultery and why it's so devastating to our culture, to our world, to the church. You think about what it does. I didn't look that scripture up. But you think about, you go back to the book of Genesis. We won't read all of this. I'm just going to mention these. But here's God. He's in chapter 2. It's more of an intimate look into God's creation of mankind, right? And in chapter 1, he gives us kind of the bare bones of how man was created in the image of God. In the image of God, he created him male and female, right? We're given that. But in chapter 2, he gets into the description of what occurs and how Adam is there in the garden. God knows that it's not good for him to be alone. And so God then brings the animal before him, but there isn't any animal that can feel that hole in Adam's heart and soul. And so then he decides, to create woman. And so he puts Adam to sleep, he removes the rib, and he forms Eve. I think it's significant in that moment that God doesn't say, here, I need to form a woman for Adam. Let me take some more clay and I'll form a physical flesh from the clay. But he actually reaches into Adam and pulls the rib out. And it's that he forms Eve. That there's this connection between Adam and Eve that isn't like any other created being. That Adam has this closeness, this intimacy with her that is reserved only for her. And that's why she's called woman. Why? Because she was taken out of man. And you get down to verse 24. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother, and what? Hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. Right, so God speaking about this most intimate of connections that we can feel as human beings is between a husband and a wife. And that's a union that wasn't formed by some kind of governmental body. There wasn't some government long ago that said, you know what, we need to institute a relationship between men and women, a bond that will last in their lives, and so we ought to do this, right? No. God said, man shall cleave to his wife and they shall become one flesh. It's God uniting those two. Jesus speaks about this too in Matthew 19, right? In a discussion on marriage and divorce and remarriage. He gets into this discussion about divorce. I won't get into that whole talk, but I did want you to note verse 4 especially. He says, have you not read that he, talking about God, who created them, Adam and Eve, from the beginning made them male and female? That God created gender. Gender's not up to human beings to decide what gender is. Right? This is a God institution. God created them male and female. He did it purposely. This is from the mind of God. And said, therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. And then Jesus adds this parenthetical at the end of that. In verse 6, he says, so they, Adam and Eve, husband and wife, they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate. And so, why is adultery a unique sin to commit? You know, if I go and I lie, am I sinning? Yeah, it's a sin, right? But does it have the same impact as me going and killing somebody? Is there a difference in those two? There is, isn't there? There's an impact that's greater, that's felt much greater. Now, are they both sinful? Will they both send me to hell if they're left unforgiven, unwashed in the blood of Christ? Absolutely. But what they do differs, right? What their ultimate scale of effect is so much different. Well, sexual sin, and in particular adultery, is sin, but it is sin of a different nature. Paul speaks about this in talking about sin, fornication, and how it's different. Because other sins that we commit are outside the body, but fornication is in the body. And it also, this kind of sin breaks a bond that only God has a right to break. And it tears away at something that only that God Himself has united together. So I just wanted to mention that. I think in particular, this sin of David, had David sinned before this? Why does God detail this particular sin? There are other sins in David's life. He wasn't a perfect person to this. He was he was a godly man, but he was a sinner. Why this sin?
Because it had consequences, and even with the acts and the consequences, if I recall correctly, it was a lasting, not just him, but it went on to affect the generations to come.
Absolutely. And we're going to talk about that in just a minute. But yeah, the effect is so much greater than some other sins. Now, ultimately, there's all sin, right? And if they're left unforgiven, it puts us in a place we don't want to be. But we can't overlook the consequences, the effect of sins like this. So, what does David do? I mentioned, there are a lot of exit doors that he had along the way. He even has an exit door right now. His exit door is to say, you know what, I have sinned, God. I have sinned so badly. He could go to Uriah and say, I have sinned, I've committed this sin against you and against your family. He doesn't take any of those. He just keeps walking. And then what does he do? He does something even worse. He tries to cover it up. And you notice over the next few verses, the text lets us know his attempt to cover it up. What does he do first? Well, first he tries to get Uriah to believe the child's his. Is David at a point yet where he feels bad about the sin, or that he feels bad about the consequences of the sin? to his life. Where's he at? You know, Paul wrote about this, 2 Corinthians chapter 7. Right, there's a difference between godly sorrow and worldly sorrow. Godly sorrow, I've committed sin, I need God's forgiveness. I have broken my covenant with God. Worldly sorrow, man, I don't want to get caught. Why did I get caught? There's a very different mindset to those two things. Where's David at?
World.
I got a child out of this. What am I going to do about this baby? And what you do notice, what's his not option? Kill the baby. Luckily, he doesn't go that route. So many in our world go that route. But he's still trying to get out of it. So what does he do? He's in Uriah. Uriah, you need to come home and be with your wife. And so he's trying to trick Uriah. So Second Samuel 11, 6 through 8. So David sent word to Joab, send me Uriah the Hittite. And Joab sent Uriah to David. When Uriah came to him, David asked, David asked how Joab was doing and how the people were doing and how the war was going. You got a lot bigger fish here, or a lot bigger thing to deal with in the war at this moment. And David is trying to be all slick and talk about the war. I got an excuse to bring him back. And then David said to Uriah, go down to your house and wash your feet. Basically, go home, make yourself at home with your wife. And Uriah went out of the king's house, and there followed him a present from the king. What happened? Well, verse 9 says, Uriah slept at the door of the king's house and with all the servants of his lord, and did not go into his house. Uriah is a better man than David right now. Why didn't Uriah go to his house? Well, Uriah said to David, the ark of Israel and Judah dwell in booths or tents, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then go to my house to eat and to drink and to lie with my wife? As you live and as your soul lives, I will not do this thing. Now David take that. He's not happy. He had a plan. Here's a foolproof plan. He's going to cover up everything. He's going to make everything okay, and we can move on with our lives. Uriah, getting in the way. Just do what I want you to do. So then what does David do? Well, we can't get him to go there on in his own cognizant mind. So what's the next thing? Then he tries to get him drunk. See, I'll mess with his mind, and I'll get him, I'll convince him that way. Well, how does that work? Verse 13. David invited him, Uriah, and he ate in his presence and drank, so that he made him drunk. See how the sin keeps piling up? Lies, and now manipulation, and now drunkenness. It's a stone rolling down the hill. In the evening he went out to lie on his couch with the servants of the Lord, but did not go to his house. What's David to do? You know, he's trying every way he can to manipulate this man to get him to do what he needs him to do. Maybe David thinks at this point, I've done all I can do. That idiot won't go to his house, won't go and lie with his wife like I want him to. How does he get to the point of wanting to murder him? I don't understand. This is so out of character with David, isn't it? This is not the normal David character. Look at how he dealt with the household of Saul. How even despite all Saul did to him, he still showed him great kindness. He even showed kindness to Saul himself. Sin changes us into something we are not. It manipulates our mind, our character, and it makes us into people that are ugly. covering up our sin corrupts us. And I'm not just talking about in the sin that it does to us, but it corrupts our person. It corrupts our thinking. It makes us do stupid things. Think about the person who is an addict, who steals from their family. The family that loves them, that cares for them, that in a sober mind they would never do. But because they need that next high, they're willing to do whatever they have to get it. David, how did you get to the point of having the man murdered? But that's what he does. David is not looking for that exit sign. And he continues down that walk of corruption. Verse 14, in the morning David wrote a letter. I just think it's not even that he, in a moment of fury, murdered him. But it is the planning. It is the purposeful taking of a life that is so out of the character of David. And here he writes a letter. How hard would it be to write that letter? And here David does it like it's nothing. He said, set your eye in the forefront of the hardest fighting. I mean, think about that. He wants to make sure it's going to happen. This man must die. And cowardly, you'd never say that about David, but in a cowardly way, he says that he may be struck. Put him in the forefront of the hardest fighting, and then draw back from him. Leave him alone to be killed by our enemies. That he may be struck down and die. David is in a terrible place. Verse 16, he sends him back to Joab. Joab, verse 16 says, the text tells us he assigned Uriah to the place where he knew there were valiant men. I don't know, why doesn't Joab, that's always perplexed me, why didn't Joab stop here and say, what are you doing? But maybe he's just going to listen to his king. His king told him to do it, that's what he's going to do. And so, that's another thing about sin, though, that I want to point out, and I'll come to you, Melinda. It is, our sin, when it gets out of hand, begins to involve others. It's not that David alone is sinning, but now he's pulling in these other people into his sin. And now he's becoming a stumbling block, not just to his own destiny, but now to Joab. Yes, ma'am.
Just real quick question. Was there any consequences? For instance, initially, when I first read it, I was thinking, why didn't Bathsheba just stay put? But is there some consequences? I know they said they sent the messenger. But what would have been, were there consequences that she would have endured had she not followed? And were there direct orders or was there? Because she knew she was there.
That's a good question. I don't know. It's the king, right?
Right.
King sending somebody to you.
If the king says do it, you better do it.
Yeah. Now, I'm not taking her guiltless, right? She participated in this too, but there's a certain power balance going on here. We'll be honest about it. David's king.
I'm sorry.
Yes, ma'am.
But I'm thinking, even with Esther, she went against what I guess their standard of behavior for dealing with the king, and nothing was.
Well, she put her life in Xerxes' hands as well, right? By going in front of him, but she had the courage to do that. And certainly, Bathsheba could have had the courage to do that. Now, I want to spend some time after this talking about Bathsheba. I mentioned this to someone else. I think Bathsheba is one of the best stories of redemption in all of Scripture. The end of her life, we'll look at that, but the end of her life, we remember this segment of her life. There's more to be written about her. And I'll save that discussion for them, but yeah. And again, David manipulating other people into his own sin. And so he's pulled these people in. And not only is he going to feel the consequences of it, but they are as well. I'm out of time here, but David sent messenger. So in verses 16 and 17, Joab does what David asked him to do. The end of verse 17 says, Uriah the Hittite also died. And David, again, he's just in this fog of delusion, of sin. I'm jumping ahead myself. He writes a letter back and says, thus you shall say to Joab, do not let this matter displease you, for the sword devours now one and now another. Strengthen your attack against the city and overthrow it. He encouraged him. Where is David at right now? He's in a really bad place. The end of verse 27. We'll pick back up in verse 26, but you notice there, this thing David had done displeased the Lord. And we'll talk about that next week. That'll be a good way to transition into the final chapter of this, when David comes to his realization of where he is. Any questions or comments? All right. Thank you, guys.